If I can just say amen and we'll go to the closing song, Ricky. I've got a bad voice. I want to just explain that first off, is that when I was in the Dominican Republic, I had a heart attack, and then I had a couple of aneurysm surgeries. One of the aneurysms is the one that feeds your brain, and one was that goes down and feeds the rest of your body. I had this surgery first, and I better put this mic up to my, I'll try to not have to strain it too much. In the process of repairing this aneurysm right here, they cut the nerve to the vocal cord on this side of my side. And so after the surgery, all I could do was really had a lot of air going out, very little action on the vocal cords. So I had a very breathy voice. I couldn't say a sentence like I am now at all. So about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, I had a surgery where there were a bunch of implants put in to the larynx on this side. So what happens is now I have a frozen larynx here, and on this side it vibrates. So half of my larynx is working. So that's why you got about half. I hope you get more than a full sermon, but you're only getting a half a voice. So, anyway, just if it gets tired, I'll drink some water, do the best you can to hear me, and I'll do my best to try to keep this microphone mat where it needs to be. So I was born in Wisconsin, grew up. I'm not a Cubby fan. I'm a Milwaukee Braves fan, who's now the Atlanta Braves, as you well know. But when I was growing up, it was Warren Spahn, Matthews, Hank Aaron, those were all the big stars in Milwaukee. But I was more so a Green Bay Packer fan, not a Bear fan. So John and I have a little adversarial relationship. We like to act like we're friends, but when football season comes, not so much. So to see me wearing the Wisconsin Badgers, Green Bay Packers every once in a while, you know where my true heart is. Well, I had a little interruption in my Wisconsin life called the Army. And my father-in-law, Alan, was a World War II vet, served in the Marines. He flew planes, transported B-51s, and 651s, right? Which ones? F-4Us. F-4Us, okay, so there. I don't know my 51s for my 4 years, so there you go. But he was flying a plane, and it had a prop on it. It didn't have a jet, and he was getting them out so they could use them out in the Pacific Warfront. So on Memorial Day, he and I both remember friends that died in training, died in battle. I had the opportunity to go with him to the Wall of Honor this last fall, when we were still up in North Carolina. And in the Vietnam Wall, there are four guys from my graduating class. Two of them were in the Catholic school in 68, and I was Oshkosh High. And I was able to honor those four men that died within 2 months of each other in Vietnam. But there's a wall, 54,000 of them, that I honor today. I had a chance when I was standing at the wall to hold a salute to those men. And if you've been at the wall, it's kind of an angle and then another angle. And I stacked up the line. Basically, everybody stood there in respect and in honor. Well, I honored those veterans. So my heart today for Memorial Day weekend is to honor those veterans that gave up their life, as Jesus gave up his life for all of us, so that we could be in a church preaching the word of God in freedom and not worries about the Gestapo coming in and closing us down in the midst of it. So after the Army, I moved to Florida. My parents came here. It was January. And I said, do I go to Wisconsin in January? Lovely weather. Or do I go to Miami, Florida? I chose wisely. So I started growing up and sailing down in Miami, Biscayne Bay, and doing a lot of good friends down there. Laser sailing, if any of you know the laser, it's an Olympic class boat. I had some success with that. And married my wife. I became a banker. Met my wife by checking credit. Married Jan in 1974. We weren't Christians. We had some problems in our marriage because she was looking for me to supply her needs. I was looking to her to supply my needs. And we had kind of a little dysfunctional thing going on. In 81, I got saved. We put Jesus in the middle of our marriage. And it healed where, and we'll talk more about that, but basically our marriage was healed in that process. Unfortunately, Jan's body was one that was plagued over our marriage with a lot of illness. And God took her in 2005. We were married 32 years, 37 years. And she 31 years. She was only 53 when she died, way too young. And we had two boys and a girl who was adopted. And they're lovely. And my oldest son has two children. I don't have any grandchildren yet. Well, I have two grandchildren. I'm sorry, two children. Of course, they're his kids, not mine. I wish they were mine. But he's a good dad. So Amelia and Beckett live in Claremont with those other two that are my son and daughter-in-law. The main thing when you're a grandparent is a grandchild, and the kids are just an accessory. Mary Ellen has four accessories and ten precious grandchildren. Right? That's right. The kids are just a way to get to the grandchildren. She also has, amazingly, that young woman has two grandchildren. One grandchild. Great-grandchildren. Two?
Three.
Three great-grandchildren. I can't keep, they keep popping out. So, I met that lovely woman in the process of, after Jan died. I'll tell the story a little more in a second. But I had met this lovely woman. We went on the mission field about... I don't know how many years into our marriage, about halfway into our marriage in 2010, 11, we went on the mission field to the Dominican Republic, served there 4.5 years. Mary Ellen did the hospitality. I basically supported a lot of the maintenance and things like that on the base. And I had a heart attack and... in 2015. God's grace brought me to Claremont, South Lake Hospital. My son was in the emergency, he was an ICU charge nurse, and got the best of care, got four stents. They found that I had those aneurysms. In December of 15, they repaired this one, lost my voice. Summer of last year, 17, this was repaired in Alabama. Vascular surgeon, about this much of my aorta had to be wrapped. There was that much, that big of an aneurysm. And then after that, I had my voice repair done at Wake Forest. So anyway, in the process of all this, I was looking for... a ministry, and God brought me here. Let's start really with the story of what happened after Jan died. After Jan died, My daughter was 15 years old. We sat there in our bedroom, in our living room, and I held Jan's hand, left the room to go to the bathroom. I had to after a while, and came back. The nurse said, "You better hurry up back out here." And my wife was in the process of passing away. I called my daughter, who was 15 then, Joanna. We watched her die, gave her to Jesus. It was a glorious time, and it'll be a memory I'll always treasure. But it was a tough thing on a 15-year-old. So I decided to take a road trip with her, get her out of that house where my wife died, and she was, you know, right there. So let's get away from it. Let's go up to Minneapolis where my brother lives. And when I was up there, I said, I'm going to visit John Piper's church. May have heard John Piper. I was really, at that time, enjoying the book Pleasures of God. If you haven't read Pleasures of God, it's really a great book about, we don't have any, it's prideful for you, Cole, to boast about your life. But God is the one entity that has a right to boast. And God is boasting about his life in that the pleasure of God is how great a creation he made, how great I am. And he can rightfully boast about himself. So I wanted to hear John. I really thought he had some good words. And I went to the, I got there late. Long story short, but God brought us to Minneapolis. We slept overnight. Didn't know how to get to my brother's house in the morning. In the daylight, I could find it. And got there mid-morning. I said, I want to go see John this morning. So I got up, and by the time I got to Bethlehem Baptist, he was halfway through the sermon. So I listened to the last half of the sermon. And then at the break, I went to the bookstore, and I found a book called Don't Waste Your Life. I also bought the New International Version that R.C. Sproul edited. At that time, it was brand new. And anyway, so I got a tape also about the book. And in this book, he talks about a missionary, a guy your age, with his wife, Michael and Mary Ellen, going off to Africa. And he's a missionary in Africa. And this young man, Michael's age here, Hunter and Mary Michael, Hunter and Mary Michael. Anyway, Michael Ryle here. You thought you were changing your name, but I'm changing his name. Yeah, she's still trying to get used to writing Ryle. Now he's got to get used to writing Michael. So, Hunter here was in Africa with his wife, and he was killed. And he's back in Iowa. She's back in Iowa. He is too, in body. You know where his soul is. He's up with Jesus. But so, here's Mary Michael grieving the loss of this young man, a promising marriage, a life still to be lived, and now she's alone. And so John is talking to Mary, saying, Mary Michael, did Hunter waste his life? Was it a thrown away life? He didn't get a chance to have babies. He didn't get a chance to have grandchildren. He'll never see children married like your dad saw you. He's going to miss all of that. You're going to miss him. Did he waste his life? And he says, no, let me tell you about a guy who wasted his life. There's a guy with his wife living in Punta Gorda, Florida. He's living in a yacht club community, golf course, golfing, boating, got the 401k, retirement, living the life that every retiree wishes they could live. We're in the Villages right now. And it's unbelievable how big a community is, how many recreation centers there are. It's just there is games, there's fun, there's everything you can do as a retiree. That's the life he's living, that kind of life. It's also the AIDS capital of Florida because of that. I mean, it's uncontrolled worldly pleasure. That's villages. I don't mean that there are a lot of Christians there, but I mean, I'm just saying that's the kind of life these people were living in Punta Gorda. And one of their prize things was their shell collection. If you've been on that side of the of Florida, you know that there are a lot of shells. You go to Sanibel Island. We used to collect shells. We used to collect jars of them, jars. And so they were very proud of their shell collection. And so John was saying, now when this man dies and he goes to heaven, he's going to present the works of his life and his most prized possession, the shell collection. So John's saying, do you want to stand before the eternal holy God of life, of everything, and say, look at this shell collection, God. Aren't you proud that I collected this? Aren't I welcome in heaven because I collected shells? Versus Hunter, who's in heaven, says, all I've got, Lord, is souls. All I've got is souls. Now, which one do you want to be? Do you want to live your life with saying this is a shell collection, or this is a life of souls? And he was just saying, that's the life where you don't waste it. So, I mean, I was really convicted by this. I mean, I lived a life as a Christian, but okay, I lost my wife. You know, life is not over. I still want to make it count so that I can live it not for shell collections, not as a retiree, but doing something that counts in heaven. So in the process of that mindset, I met Mary Ellen. I knew her from Jupiter Christian School. I was on the board. She was an executive secretary in there. So I knew her because of the board interaction. But I met her through a set of circumstances, which we laugh about, pecans. And we had a pecan wedding. We didn't do chocolate cake with all that stuff. We did pecans. And anyway, in the process of trying to get the school so they would continue to get pecans for the holidays, I found out that she really had a love for missions. And as you know, with that mindset of saying, I want to serve God, I really liked her mindset of wanting to do missions. And so we got attracted, love, marriage, and the next thing I know, we were married in January, and in March, she's going off on a two-week mission trip, or 1 week, whichever it was, and leaving me home alone. We're newlyweds. And he's off. You took off. That's basically what happened, Mary Michael. Yeah. Gee, what a marriage is this? She came home from the mission trip and she said, who are you and where do I live? She didn't even remember where we lived anymore because we were only married for, you know, we only got home. We were home a couple weeks from Costa Rica and off you went. But so that was the beginning of a whirlwind of short-term mission trips that we took with Jupiter Christian School. Well, next thing you know, I'm the supervisor, guardian for a bunch of high school boys in Dominican Republic in a cabin. She's got the girls, I've got the boys, and we're on a two-week trip in the spring. Or maybe it's only 1 week, it doesn't matter. But anyway, it's in March of 2010, I think. And these boys are high school boys. And these guys, decided there was one guy in particular, there was a little bit of ruckus, and he decided to pull a prank. Well, the day before he decided this, I had pulled my back. So I was really hurting. And so by the time I got to bed, it was just me and pain pills, you know? So I'm sitting there in the middle of the night, and suddenly I feel this wetness on the side of my head. So I get up, and turns out it's shaving cream. Not only is it on my head, but it's on the floor. This is me trying to just stay upright with a bad back. And there's shaving cream and a slippery floor on my way to the bathroom to try to clean myself up. So, needless to say, after I confronted him, and I said, you know, I had the guys together. I said, nobody's going anywhere till somebody confesses. And he confessed. We forgave. You know, I think it was an effective lesson for him about the seriousness of what we were there to do. We weren't there to play games. We were there to reach people for Christ. And so, I mean, it was an effective lesson for those guys. And I ended up releasing my anger to God and getting on with it. But I told Mary Ellen when we finished with that lovely experience that I'm never going to go on another mission trip with high school boys. You know what happens when you tell God you're never going to do something? Yeah. Yeah. I recommend you do it for anything that you really want to do, because God's going to get you to do it. So, in God and his humor, the summer mission trip, that summer, 3 months later, June, God pulls the leaders that we're going to go take that trip. Hey, we can't take this trip. We need somebody else. So, Miss Missionary over there volunteers me to go with her with more high school kids. And so they were graduates, to be honest. They were halfway to college. Anyway, in the midst of that, we go to the summer mission trip. And had a great time. They're wonderful kids. They were, it really was a blessing. And in the midst of it, I mean, it's just, I don't know how much time we have. What is 11:45 already? So much for the lesson. In the midst of it, we lost our luggage. The flight was from Miami to the Dominican Republic. No change of planes. Go from here to there, get off the plane, go to Jarabacoa. Well, the airlines, American, decided that I recommend them. They're great, except that if you don't count on your luggage getting there. Of the 14 pieces of luggage, 12 of them are left on the tarmac so that they can make room for the commercial baggage that people were paying for to get over to the Dominican Republic. They bumped ours. So our 12 of 14 were left on the tarmac. The next day, Mary Ellen and I climb in the car with the leader, manager of the Dominican site, of the Dominican Republic country, really, for the mission group we're in. And on the way there, we said, you know, we really have a heart to do hospitality. We thought about doing hospitality when we visited Costa Rica earlier that year. And maybe it was the year before, Mary Ellen, you know. She has a memory, I don't. But we had a heart. We said maybe we could do missions and do a hospitality home for the groups that come. And so we said we had that, but that didn't work out. So, you know, we're really glad to be here on this mission, and, you know, we'll get the luggage. So this guy almost drove off the road when I said that. We didn't know why. Well, next week he says, when you said that, you had no way of knowing that we're actually planning on leaving Dominican Republic and going and starting a work in Nicaragua. And we need somebody to come and replace us doing hospitality. Lost luggage left to us, talking to the guy, left him saying, you're the guys that are going to fill our place. So in God's provision, we ended up, I was president of the bank. I was president of the bank then. And he says, oh, by the way, you're called. So I'm saying, okay, how's this going to work? I'm going to be president of the bank and I'm going to be a missionary in the Dominican Republic. How's that going to happen? So I'm going back home, and we walk into church that Sunday morning. Not going to tell anybody. We agreed. We're going to keep this all quiet, see what God says, because we really aren't. Can this be? I mean, she's got a career at the school. I got a career at the bank. And God Almighty, I'm president. You know, so we can't just walk away. And so we go. Fly in Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning we're in church. We have a guy named John Glass who's the sermon. He's a guest sermon like me. He's from Switzerland, a missionary. And he says, I have a message for you today. I don't know who it applies to, but it is, how do you know you've been called to be a missionary? Mary Ellen and I looked at each other and said, oh boy. Seat belts, time, here we go. So he goes through the biblical reasons, biblical thoughts about why you should know you're called to be a missionary. One of the points, among many, is your friends will confirm your call. People who know you best, Mary Ellen, will say, you're the one. We go into Sunday school, literally saying, what just happened? And Mary Ellen's one of her best friends from the school. So Mary Ellen, you know, I can never do that mission thing like he's talking about. But when he talked about it, I immediately thought of you. She didn't know anything. I mean, she said, Mary Ellen, you're called. Mary Ellen, we hear this story and we say, so I get up in the Sunday school. And I tell them, this is what's going on. We feel like we've been, we were trying to decide whether we're called, and this just happened. So the teacher at Sunday school is, she's a three-year missionary in Russia. He says, I want to tell you what you're going to go through as you prepare to go on the mission field. And he gives a lesson to us on what we're going to have to do for the next couple of months. Right? So the next thing you know, we're missionaries in the Dominican Republic. While we're there, our job was to prepare meals. My job was to make sure the toilets were working. I go through the cabins after every team would leave and fix broken faucets, fix things that had fallen down, fixed the windows that were, there was a mechanism to keep the windows open, so I'd fix those, and I'd do my job. But what my call was these young men, like Tyler, like Hunter, like Tim, that would come into this thing, and into this mission thing, and I'd be a dad figure to him. So I would sit with these guys. I'd see one sitting by himself. There's Eric. Let me go sit with Eric. And the next thing I'm talking to Eric, what's your goal in life? What do you think? What are you trying to get out of this mission? And I would start relating to these guys. And what's your thing in life? So I really developed a desire to have a ministry with young men. And sometimes in the hall, in public, I would meet with women, never in private. But, I'd sit with them and they'd be there and have a group of gals and talking about the same deal. So God gave me a through a number of difficulties in the mission thing, I ended up with an opportunity to teach some lessons, to do some things with the kids, and have some leadership role there. Had the heart attack, and so that's out the window. I come here, have this surgery, I have no voice. So I'm saying, God, what are you up to? You talk about these trials that come at you, and like John talked about, you know, I certainly trust in you, God, for salvation. But what about that ministry that you promised me, that I feel convicted about, that you gave me? And I just didn't see how it would work. So anyway, we're sitting here with Mom and Dad, and recovering from these surgeries, and taking care of them so that they wouldn't have to be in a nursing home. We want them to live independently. So we're giving up our lives gladly so that we can live with them and enjoy their company and have fun, and they can live in their home, not in a nursing home. So it's been a blessing to live with a World War II veteran and his wife, honoring them with our lives with them. So, but that's fine. But what about my call? So we're going to a church that's a fine one in Orlando. And God opened our eyes and ears to the fact that there's a church to college and career kids. Now, I call you kids. I know you're older. But, you know, to me, anybody under 40, including John, is a kid. And so God answered my prayer by me standing up here, by my meeting with Tim and scoodles of you guys. And I want to meet with more of you guys because that's my ministry. You're not bothering me when I get to meet with you at breakfast or lunch or whatever over coffee like we have, you know, because it's a gift to me, Mike, when I'm meeting with you and your lovely to-be bride. And so, anyway, that's where God has me right now. He's answered a prayer and brought me here. Now, it's almost time to quit the sermon, but if you'd go ahead and let's do it the verse, first of all. Do 1 Peter 1. Okay. So we were, go to the next one. Basically, you're exiles, you're strangers in a foreign land. That was when you're a missionary, when you're lost, when you're a Christian in this world, you're a lost person. And yet, here we are now able to have a hope, a grace and peace that's yours in abundance because we've been chosen. Okay, so you're 13. So now, we have a transition that goes through to go from being in the world without any defenses to a world where we've got hope. And the hope is obedience and into a holy life with God. And so he says, set your minds so that they're alert and fully sober, so that your hope and grace will be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at the coming. Go ahead and put the other slide, next slide up, with the image of you in the middle. Yeah. So basically, chapter 1, what John talked about is we've got trials coming at you. You got no hope. You've got terrorists in the school. You got school shootings. You got a corrupt government. You got all kinds of scandal going on. You're meeting self-centered people. You got road rage going on. You never know when you're going to run into somebody who is going to attack you, either because of the world or because of the way, you know, things happen with these trials. So you got all that coming at you, and the other slide, the next slide is you're trying to make it in this world as best you can. You're selfish, and you've got to be self-centered. One preacher of mine used to say, get all you can while you can for the big eye. Get all you can while you can for the big eye. That's you without God. You're prideful. It's my life, my way in relationships. People are in the way of what I want to get. They're just, I've got to, at work, when I was in the bank, a lot of people trying to get to the top. And people were just in the way of their ambitions, of their success. So there's got to be a transition that happens. So what happens is what Peter is saying, in obedience, set your minds, get sober thinking going on. Get rid of thinking about things of this world and all of the things that you want as far as evil. Get your minds ready to run. Basically, he says, be prepared. Pull up your robe and tuck it in your belt so you're ready to run the race. Get ready. And he says, in obedience, give yourself to God. Release yourself from sin. Forgiveness. Ask for forgiveness from God. And be cleansed. Now, you've got a new you surrounded by grace. So, in the world, you're going to have you still with the world, the flesh, and the devil all coming at you. The world, full of its trials. You got all of the same problems that were on the right side of that screen still coming at you. But what's between you and that is grace and God's love. You're in the center of his love, and he has promised the hope that we have, the living hope, is that we're promised to be protected from the world. Your flesh is still with you, and it wants to do what Romans 7 says, I do what I don't want to do. And God says, I will make you a way where you can be in charge of your flesh. And the flesh isn't in charge of you. So that's why, even though you still have the flesh in you, you're able to control it. You're free from its control. And the devil, he's going to do everything he can to mess up your life. He's going to throw things at you. He's going to throw temptations at you. And how do you stop it? By being in God's grace and having that hope. There's another aspect of you being in God, though. The next slide. You music guys, if you want to come up, it's any time you can. So I think we're close to wanting to wrap this up. But you, in God, now you can have spiritual fruit. You can have love and joy and peace going out from you because you're not looking to be the world to feed your ego, to feel your pride, to build you up. Now you're able to give out. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. Your marriage. You're not looking for, I've got to have Mary Michael meet all my needs. I've got to have Hunter meet all my needs. Now I'm in the middle where God is meeting 100% of your needs, 100% there, and you're able to give to each other, having all of your needs met in Christ, all of your needs met in Christ. Now the marriage works. Now you have spiritual gifts. And when you're saved, I'm able to do hospitality. I'm able to do prophecy. I'm able to service. I'm able to show mercy. I have spiritual gifts that I'm able to give because of God. You want to be a leader? You want to be in charge? You want to be a president? The world says you can be president, and it's a miserable life. I want to tell you, if I were without God when I was president, but are miserable. People coming at you all the time, making decisions. You're the last guy. You got to make decisions. The buck stops there. It's miserable life. You got a board of directors looking to sharpshoot you every board meeting. I don't recommend it. Thank God, you wouldn't believe the miracles that happened to me, board meeting after board meeting after board meeting. FDIC coming in saying, I'm going to take your bank and I'm going to downgrade it. God walking, them walking away from the bank after 2 weeks of examining the bank saying, you know, if there's anything, we can't recommend anything you do better. You're doing the bank, you're running the bank exactly the way we'd recommend, and we don't have any criticism to give you. That's God. Guy come in, I'm going to downgrade you. 2 weeks later, you're doing everything fine, I can't say anything. The state comes in and says the same thing. Said, in fact, the FDIC guy, the assistant, said, can I come go work for you? That's how the attitudes were changed. That's God in, when you're a leader. He does the same thing in church, doesn't he, John? Yeah. So, are you able to resist the devil? Yeah. Do you have a life of hope? Yeah, because you aren't alone. Okay, I've had a heart attack. I don't have any mission. Yeah, I have a hope. I have a living hope. Psalm 34 talks about David. David in 1 Samuel 20s, 21, 22, basically is fighting off in the desert. He's in the Philistines. He's living with them. Then he gets to be disliked by the Philistines because they found out, well, Saul killed 1,000. He killed 10,000. They're saying, so David has to basically get away from the Philistines. And while he's out in the desert, Saul finds out he's out in the desert, comes after him with an army. He's on one side of the mountain. Saul's on the other side of the mountain. And suddenly Saul gets word the Philistines are attacking this village. So Saul has to go protect the village. He had David literally trapped. Later on, God gives Saul in a cave, going to the bathroom. Somebody named David cuts off his robe, cuts off a corner. And so God did all of this for David. But I really like the picture of David being this humble guy that had to go to the point of acting insane so that the Philistines would drive him away rather than keeping him there in 1 Samuel 22, I think it is. So go ahead and put Psalm 34 up. This humble man says, I will extol you at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. I will glory in God. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. You know who the afflicted are? Another version says the humble will hear and rejoice. Not the prideful, not the people that are totally into themselves, but those folks that say, I can't do it on my own. I can't make it in this world with all of these enemies and with my weakness of trying to do everything on myself, the burden is going to be too much. You're going to collapse. But a humble guy can rejoice and we can glorify God together. We can exalt him together because we are success. Go ahead to the next one, verse. He sought the Lord and he answered him. He delivered him. He's a God who delivers. Your enemy is on this side of the mountain. He's ready to take you down. And what happens? God will deliver you. He's delivered me from so many things. I promise you, he is there and a faithful deliverer. The next verse. Look to him, radiant their faces are never covered with shame. I was never shaved in a boardroom. I told them things that God told me. I went into the interview to become a president. God told me what to say to him before I even went in there. You're never put to shame. with God. Your poor man calls, and the Lord hears you and saves you out of all his troubles. If you're a humble, contrite guy, obedient to God or woman, and you're before him in a humble spirit, like David, you call on him, he will make you a king of men, a leader of men, a success. You know, what is success? Is success money? Is it success shell collections? Where are you going to put your ladder against? You're going to put your ladder against this wall that says, I'm going to chase a life of success. I'm going to chase a life of security. I'm going to get married, and my husband is going to keep me safe and secure all my life. I'm going to chase that ladder. And then illness happens. And then you get fired from a job. And you think you're secure, and you suddenly find out that by this much skin of your teeth, you're going to get your house foreclosed on. Been there. Right in the middle of success. Bang. No job. In the midst of, what am I going to do now? Couldn't get back into banking. Ready to commit suicide. One day, sitting in a park, having gone to the ocean instead of to my job to the west, thinking, you know, all morning, oh, I'm going to commit suicide. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers him. That afternoon, I'm in a park reading Psalms and realizing, you know, who I am in God. Realizing that ending my life wasn't going to be a solution. Recommitting my life to God, trusting in him that things are not hopeless. There is always hope in God. You're never at the end of your rope with God. I mean, you have no voice. You have no body. You're in a hospital, helpless because you've been cut open and nobody's hearing the call. You don't have a voice. I was in ICU in Gainesville, having just been cut open. Couldn't lift myself up. Totally hopeless the first night after surgery. The bed collapses. The air bed collapses. I'm trapped in the bed. And nobody can hear my voice. There's a lot of chaos going on in there. It's Christmas time. They're partying. Nobody comes to check me. They look. He's still sleeping. I couldn't do anything. I look like I was sleeping. I'm sitting there terrified that nobody could hear me. And I'm trapped. And no call, but nothing. It wasn't until the morning somebody rescued me. But the Lord delivers me. He delivered me. And I recovered. And it's many pictures I have in my life of that situation. But it's a traumatic thing when you think you're alone and you got no hope. But I tell you, David had hope. David was a foreigner, a stranger, in an alien in a land. That's 1 Peter 1. But God gives him hope, you know? So I'll go ahead and pray, John, and let you. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much that we're never without hope. In you, God, we are.